six men who succeeded him have Southern roots. I don't think you could have had another Southern president without the Voting Rights Act, says Katzenbach. You needed it to legitimize Southern politicians in the North. The 2000 race proves the point. Frontrunners George W. Bush and Al Gore each hail from former Confederate states. It's a situation that would no doubt make Johnson proud, except for the fact that the candidate from Texas is a Republican.
It's a little difficult to remember the demure and retiring image favored by Lady Bird Johnson, who was a tough, smart businesswoman in her own right. This tape from March 7th, 1964, offers a glimpse of her in the role of political advisor. LBJ had just completed a televised press conference from the White House.
You want to listen for about 1 minute to my critique, or would you rather wait till
tonight?
Yes,
ma'am. I'm with her now.
I thought that you looked strong, firm, and like a reliable guy. Your looks were splendid. The close-ups were much better than the distance ones.
Well, you can't get them as good.
Well, I would say this. There were more close-ups than there were distance ones. During the statement, you were a little breathless, and there was too much looking down, and I think it was a little too fast. Not enough change of pace. Drop in voice at the end of sentence. There was a considerable pickup in drama and interest when the questioning began. Your voice was noticeably better, and your facial expression was noticeably better. Every now and then you need a good, crisp answer for change of pace, and therefore I was very glad when you answered one man. The answer is no to both of your questions. I think the outstanding things were that the close-ups were excellent. You need to learn, when you're going to have a prepared text, you need to have the opportunity to study it a little bit more and to read it with a little more conviction and interest and change of pace.
Well, the trouble is that they criticize you for taking so much time. They won't use it all for questions. Then the questions don't produce any news. If you don't give news, you catch hell. So my problem was trying to get through before 10 minutes, and I still ran 10 minutes a day.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a third of it for the questions. And I could have taken, if I'd read it like I wanted to, 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't know what to cut out.
Mm-hmm. I believe if I'd had that choice, I would have said, use 13 minutes or 14 for the statement. In general, I'd say it was a good B plus.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear recording library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Texas Monthly Magazine, followed by Travelin' Texas at 4.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 69 and clear. Tonight, a few showers with a low in the upper 40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 50s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 3 p.m.
It's in Texas. It's in Texas Monthly. Howdy. Welcome to our program. I'm KC Dobe, and this is Texas Monthly Magazine on site and sound broadcasting. First article from our new January issue, one of our feature articles by Michael Hall. It's entitled, Seven Ages of Barry Corbin. From Urban Cowboy to Northern Exposure to No Country for Old Men, Texas' finest character actor isn't hanging up his spurs just yet. Barry Corbin got a funny look in his eye. All the world's a stage, he intoned, leaning forward and peering at me, and all the men and women merely players. His deep, familiar drawl followed the cadence of Shakespeare's words. They have their exits and their entrances, and each man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. The actor, who played shady Sheriff Fenton Washburn in Dallas, Centennial, Uncle Bob, and Urban Cowboy, and dim-witted Roscoe Brown and Lonesome Dove paused for effect sitting in his Fort Worth home. Corbin has no hair on the top of his head, and alopecia has just about claimed his eyebrows, but a prodigious gray goatee encircles his mouth. He has an impish air, even when interpreting the bard. At first, the infant, mewling and puking, spit out the word, in his nurse's arms. Then the schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face creeping like a snail, unwillingly to school. The leather sofa beneath him creaked, and then the lover, sighing like furnace with a woeful ballad writ to his mistress's eyebrow. We'd been talking about some of the hundreds of roles Corbin has played in his career, from old cranks and lawmen to Falstaff and Macbeth. He said that he's always loved Shakespeare, which led to his impromptu performance of Jacques' melancholy Seven Ages of Man soliloquy from As You Like It. He cruised through the stages, youth, middle age, retired old fart, squatting his thigh, raising and lowering his voice to emphasize notes of vigor and lassitude, ambition and loss. As he neared the end, he slowed his speech and looked down at his hands. Last stage of all that ends this strange eventful history, his second childishness and mere oblivion, sans teeth, sans taste, sans eyes, sans, took one final pause, everything. I was the lone member of Corbin's audience, but I applauded, and his face broke into the broad smile I knew from so many of his roles. For a moment, I pictured Uncle Bob in his hard hat, beaming at John Travolta and stuffing some chaw into his mouth after reciting another famous monologue, this one about swallowing, or as Corbin pronounced it, swallering one's pride, right before Uncle Bob was tragically struck by lightning. I asked Corbin if that was his favorite bit of Shakespeare. Not really, he said, but it's one that means something to me the older I get. It means more and more to me because I've been through all the stages. I'm in the last stage, without any teeth. Corbin turned 80 in October, and up until the pandemic, he was still working, appearing in the Fox drama 911 Lone Star, and playing a stubborn old man who refuses to leave his home on Better Call Saul. Corbin has always kept busy. Over his 60-year career, he's had more than 200 roles on stage, on TV, and in the movies. They've mostly been supporting roles, often authority figures, a natural fit given his large frame and confident presence. He's played 15 sheriffs, several generals, a few wise uncles, a swaggering astronaut, and a hardcore basketball coach. He's also played psychotic patriarchs, wealthy Texans, Santa Claus, and Lyndon Johnson. Even when his characters are overbearing or murderous, Corbin finds ways to make them human and likable, so much so that he often steals the show, as he did portraying General Jack Barringer in War Games and astronaut Maurice Minifield in Northern Exposure. Known as a character actor, he always seems like he's genuinely enduring whatever his character is enduring, while also somehow remaining very Corbin. The way he talks has a lot to do with this. Corbin speaks in a comfortable lilt, an accent that rolls out of his mouth, more drawl than twang. It's flat but musical, slightly nasal with a bit of a rasp. When he speaks deliberately, which he often does, his voice is deep and resonant. It sounds like he knows what he's talking about, like he can be trusted, means what he says. It's a voice that has narrated documentaries on everything from the space program and Old West gunfighters to the history of Harley-Davidson motorcycles, that has read audiobooks of American lore like Old Yeller, and the 1930s Max Brand pulp cowboy tales, that for more than 20 years he was the voice of promo reads for Fort Worth country station 99.5 The Wolf, delivering lines like, "I'd rather be a fence post in Texas than a king in Tennessee." You'll hear a lot of accents like Corbin's if you go to the Llano Estacado, also known as the Southern Plains, an area that in Texas runs east of New Mexico, south of the Canadian River in the Panhandle, north of the Hill Country, and west of Wichita Falls. If there's a capital of this region, it's Lubbock, also known as Hub City. Llano Estacado is flat, tough country, scrub, stones, and sand. Corbin likes to say of the South Plains accent, it's flat like the land, it's really part of the land. I tell people it has to do with ingesting a lot of sand growing up. Leonard Barry Corbin was born October 16, 1940, in the ranching and cotton town of La Mesa, 60 miles south of Lubbock, and grew up mewling into the wind roared down the plains from Canada. His paternal grandfather had moved to La Mesa from Lampasas in the 20s because he wanted to raise cotton, and the land there looked good. It was beautiful green country, Corbin said, recalling the family's pre-Dust Bowl creation myth, like the Garden of Eden. The boys' parents, Kilmer and Alma Corbin, were school teachers who married young. Kilmer had been stricken by polio as a child, which limited the use of his right hand and left him unable to do farm work. He developed into a bookish kid. Photos from his youth, everyone else wears suspenders while Kilmer sports a dress shirt and tie. Alma, who had been born in a covered wagon on the trip to La Mesa, named her first son after J.M. Barrie, the author of Peter Pan. When Barrie reached school age, he became Barrie, B-A-R-R-Y, to differentiate himself from a female classmate who had the same name. Though his parents weren't horse people, Barrie spent summers at his grandfather's, who put him in the saddle every day. He loved the feeling. A horse wants to do whatever you want him to do, Corbin told me. If you want to compare it to being one entity, you're the brain and the horse is the body. You've got to be in sync with the horse. Got to make him think whatever you're going to do is coordinated and make him think it's his idea. Then you get along. The Corbin family, brother Blaine and sister Jane, followed Barrie, lived just north of La Mesa on Highway 87 in a house across the road from a cotton gin and down the street from the school where Kilmer and Almer taught. Kilmer, an FDR Democrat, was an ambitious young man who at 22 decided to run for county judge and won. When he set his sights on the state Senate in 1948, his firstborn helped nail up posters and hand out cards on the courthouse square. Kilmer won, becoming the youngest senator in the legislature. After he served two terms, the family settled in Lubbock, where Kilmer, who lacked a law degree but had passed the state bar exam, opened a legal practice. He would take Barrie with him on Saturdays when he visited clients to collect payment. Sometimes folks would try to negotiate, pulling out a bottle of whiskey or offering up a chicken or goat. Corbin remembers the banter from those long-gone interactions. He says the way folks talk in the Southern Plains is something they carry proudly throughout their lives, but it's not just how they talk, it's what they say. A big part of our identity is telling stories, he told me. The expanse of the land required people there to learn to fend for themselves and to entertain themselves. Most of us became storytellers out of boredom. Many others from the Southern Plains, Terry Allen, Joe Ely, Buddy Holly, Wenna Jennings, became musicians for similar reasons. There was nothing else to do. There's an attitude from people who come from this part of the state, says Lubbock-born songwriter and poet Andy Wilkinson. You see it in musicians and artists, something here that causes people to have a combination of a perfect sense of self-confidence and a perfect sense of humility that carries over into the way a person presents itself. A lot of that is in his voice. Like most people in the area, Corbin says hotel, tornado, can't. He drops the letter G at the end of words. You can hear this to great effect when you listen to his narration of Buffalo Altar, a Texas Symphony, a 1998 piece of music and writing by J. Todd Frazier and Stephen Harrigan. It's a love letter to old Texas, an 81-year-old oil man's reminiscence of wild days gone by, including the time 50 years earlier when he and an elderly rancher entered a cave and watched the sun rise over an altar of ancient buffalo jawbones. In each public performance, Corbin, wearing a white Stetson, would stand on stage and read the story, weaving in and out with the music. Texas is what connects me and that prehistoric fella and that old rancher and that dead buffalo, he'd say, interlocking his fingers. It's not just the place we live in, it's the place that lives in us, even after we're dead looking toward the sun with empty eyes. Harrigan was moved every time he heard Corbin recite the story. There's a co-authorship level when a great actor is reading your work, Harrigan told me. It's a mysterious process. Barrie enhances every word. He adds something that wasn't there before. Corbin told me that in his long career, he's occasionally had trouble with directors over his voice, but it's happened only in New York and only in the theater. You don't talk that way on stage, they would tell him. Corbin would shake his head and reply, no, this is me. That's what I talk like. If it bothers you, then you've got to find somebody else. From an early age, Corbin remembers he's been observing the people around him, listening to them talk, discerning their differences, taking mental notes. In high school, when he wasn't buying horses to retrain and sell at a profit, he was people watching at the Purple Onion, a gathering place for local beatniks near Texas Tech University. Go in, there'd be a fellow older, about 30. He'd grown a beard and wore a beret, walked around with a walking stick, Corbin said. There'd be people doing bad Allen Ginsberg-like poetry, snapping their fingers. You'd order a cup of espresso. They'd put 5 teaspoons of instant coffee in a cup, pour boiling water over it, put a peppermint stick in there, and charge you 75 cents. By the time Corbin got to Tech in 1959, he looked like a young, roguish English actor. 6 feet tall, 160 pounds, black hair and dark brown eyes. He had acted throughout high school and was determined to continue in college. His freshman year, he wore a fat suit to play Falstaff in The Merry Wives of Windsor. He took Shakespeare seriously and devoured the playwright's complete works. "I wanted to see what was there," Corbin told me. "A play like Hamlet, there's so much there that you miss it the first time. A play like Macbeth, it's almost a modern play, a shortage play, and some of them are just not worth reading, hardly, like As You Like It." Corbin wasn't a great student, but he was already developing into a fine actor, playing parts in modern dramas like A View from the Bridge. He was a gregarious free spirit, and if he didn't like the plays the theater department had scheduled for an upcoming semester, he would drop out and work on an oil rig, soaking up another world's characters and their stories. Corbin didn't graduate, and in 1961 he joined the Marines, spending 2 years at Camp Pendleton in Southern California. When he returned to Lubbock, he jumped back into acting. Jamie Howell, an actor who shared the stage with Corbin at Tech, said Corbin was already on a different level from other community theater performance. "It was like watching a major leaguer play with some AA players," Howell told me. "He had this transportive ability. He could take an audience to a place where he was taking himself. He touched your soul in some way, and I'm talking about touching the soul of West Texans, who are not easy to touch." In 1965, Corbin married his girlfriend, Mary Elise Soap, who was also an actor. Lubbock didn't offer many opportunities for the couple to pursue their stage ambitions, so they headed east. He spent a year in Chicago, where Corbin worked at a bookstore and did a community theater production of Harold Pinter's The Caretaker. He spent time in Raleigh, where Corbin taught acting at North Carolina State University, and he performed in Ghosts by Henrik Ibsen. He also played Mercutio in Romeo and Juliet at the famed Bardo Theater in Abingdon, Virginia. The older Corbin got, the more fascinated he grew with his craft, creating flesh-and-blood characters from written dialogue. With each new town and each new production, he learned new ways of deploying his voice, face, and body to transport himself and the people who watched him. Corbin moved to New York in 1967, with Soap eventually joining him, and the couple settled in Greenwich Village. He decorated their kitchen with photos of horses, cowboys, and buffalo. He hung a Texas flag on the wall. Although he acted on Broadway, Corbin also used the city as a base to venture elsewhere, the American Shakespeare Festival in Stratford, Connecticut, and several dinner theaters in the Northeast. In 1970, Corbin and Soap had a son, Bernard, though not long after the couple divorced. Corbin held on to the apartment, but hit the road for more stage work. Alabama, Mississippi, Massachusetts. Some nights he slept in his car. He enjoyed the itinerant life, doing roles he knew, subbing for other actors, stumbling upon new opportunities. In 1976, while driving back to New York, he stopped in Atlanta to visit a friend and heard about an audition for a local TV shoot. Corbin ended up getting the part, playing the world's greatest hot air balloon pilot in Moving On, and he did some other TV, a guest spot in an episode of Hawaii Five-O, a hitman in the Andros Targets. That year, he married Susan Berger, a fellow actor he had met in Alabama. The two moved into Corbin's apartment, and he went back to touring. Life was good. He got to do what he loved, and he was successful at it. Then, in July of 1977, New York was hit by a blackout. The city was already in financial chaos, plus the Son of Sam was on the loose. After hunkering down through a hectic night of looting, miserable heat, food spoiling in the refrigerator, Corbin decided he had had enough. He was approaching 40 and wanted to see if he could make a childhood dream come true. He and Berger drove to Los Angeles. While Corbin was learning to act, he was also learning to write, plays and filling them with characters he knew from home. His first finished piece was Sucker Rod Smith and the Cisco Kid, in which a young man from Queens heads to Hollywood to become a movie cowboy and stops along the way at a bar in West Texas. There he meets, among others, free-spirited Sucker Rod Smith, the name comes from the oil well part, who's based on Corbin's grandfather. The play had runs in Alabama and Southern California. While serving as a playwright in residence at the University of South Alabama in 1974, Corbin wrote that these characters had lived in his head since he left home 9 years earlier. Some of them are dead, some are alive, but they're all full of life, breath, blood, bone to me. When Corbin arrived in L.A., he penned a longer play called The Whiz Bang Cafe, which involved a collection of personalities at a truck stop in Throckmorton, Texas, about halfway between Lubbock and Fort Worth. Corbin was part of a troupe performing the play, and he invited an agent to see it. She liked his writing, but loved his acting. She got him an audition, which led to his first big screen role, Uncle Bob in Urban Cowboy. Corbin, a 39-year-old film rookie, looked completely at ease with star John Travolta, smiling, smoking a pipe, dispensing country wisdom. One of the emotional peaks of the film comes toward the end when Bob is killed by lightning. But immediately before that, he gives his nephew Bud, Travolta, some avuncular advice on dealing with his estranged wife. The director thought the lines, as written, were too bare, so the day before shooting, he asked Corbin to punch them up. Corbin thought back to his childhood and the cantaloupes his grandmother had grown next to her garage, and then let his imagination go. In the scene, Bob told Bud exactly why he had swallowed his pride numerous times. Without Corrine and them kids, hell, I'd just be another old pile of dog shit in a cantaloupe patch, just drawing flies. Travolta, who didn't know the line was coming out, let out a delighted snicker, as did audiences nationwide, who had come in droves to see the movie. Throughout the early 80s, Corbin laid the groundwork for decades of future TV law enforcement roles with his performance as Sheriff Fenton Washburn in Dallas, a crooked and engaging lawman. He also had supporting turns in two box office hits, as a prison warden in the Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor comedy Stir Crazy, and as a wealthy Texas gambler in Clint Eastwood's Any Which Way You Can. Nothing, however, could have prepared him for the success of War Games in 1983. Corbin played Jack Barringer, a four-star general who has to prevent a computer-driven World War III started unknowingly by a teenage hacker played by Matthew Broderick. Once again, a director asked Corbin to get inside his character's head and add some dialogue. John Badham told the actor that Barringer needed to utter a line showing how desperate the situation was and suggested that, since none of the adults could head off nuclear annihilation, they turned to the teen. Corbin assured Badham he'd figure something out, and he remembered a day back in La Mesa when he had dared his cousin to urinate into the engine of a tractor their grandfather had left running in a field. The next day, at the appointed time, Corbin cried, "God damn it, I'd piss on a spark plug if I thought it'd do any good. Let the boy in there, Major." By then, Corbin and Berger had two sons, James and Chris, and Corbin had built a reputation for versatility and a sense of humor. He got to use both in 1990 when, at age 50, he landed the TV role that, for many, defines him. The arrogant ex-astronaut Maurice Minifield, who runs the town of Sicily, Alaska. Northern exposure was witty and weird, and Corbin helped set the tone, playing a macho man who loved show tunes, a braggart who cried, and a hothead with a big smile. One of Corbin's close friends on set was John Cullum, also a veteran stage actor, who played tavern owner Holling Vincour. At the end of the very first episode, the two men, each vying for the same woman's affection, come together to settle their beef. Corbin's character, the loser, tells Cullum about his experience floating in space. "Is that what it's like, Holling?" Corbin asks as his face collapses into tears. "Being in love?" Cullum told me that he and others on the set were often in awe of Corbin. "Barry is such a good actor that sometimes he doesn't realize he's acting. That's the most perfect acting you can do. It's so natural that it's really him. He was totally authentic, almost a method actor. He deliberately created this character of Maurice." Corbin was happy playing a minor and ensemble parts. The roles kept him working, and they were often more interesting than playing the lead. Being a movie star, he would say, is the biggest pain in the world. Of all his roles, Corbin's favorites have been in old-fashioned westerns, the ones with cowboys, horses, and triumphant good guys. "The western is our mythology," he told me. Usually in a western, the hero is a guy who, well, what John Wayne said, courage is being scared to death and saddling up anyway. And that's pretty much what a Western ought to be. He learned to love them as a boy, spending Saturday afternoons in La Mesa's majestic theater. "We'd be hollering and carrying on," Corbin recalled. "There'd be a few of the local cowboys from the ranches who came in on horseback. They'd just hobble their horses out on a courthouse square and let them graze on the grass and go in and watch the picture show." Corbin and his friends would bring cap pistols to express their disapproval during musical numbers. "Whenever they'd start singing, we'd start popping off them caps," he said. "We didn't care for them to sing." He adored the heroes, Gary Cooper, John Wayne, but was intrigued by horsemen like Ben Johnson and bit players like George Gabby Hayes and the comic actor Al St. John, who performed in westerns under the name Fuzzy Q. Jones. "I could do that," Corbin thought. When he and his friends got home, they would divvy up parts from the movie and act it out all over again. He decided to be an actor when he grew up, but not a leading man. He wanted to be a character. In some of his favorite screen roles, he'd ride horses, often imagining he was playing his grandfather. "Once I get on a horse, I feel like I'm whole," he told me. "I'm walking around afoot. I feel like I'm missing something." One of those performances was in Lonesome Dove. Corbin had read the novel and told his agent he'd take any part in the 1989 adaptation. Another was in Conniger, which made a couple years later, in which Corbin played a good-hearted stagecoach driver who helps the hero, Sam Elliott, get the girl. For the movie, Corbin had to learn to drive a team of six horses, something he hadn't done before, but he was such a natural that he learned in 2 days. Corbin loved the horse operas, but his turns in Dallas and Urban Cowboy solidified his standing in modern westerns. Perhaps his most memorable character was Uncle Ellis, 2007's No Country for Old Men. Corbin plays a former Texas lawman who's been paralyzed from the waist down by a bullet, and he shares his scene with Tommy Lee Jones, who portrays his nephew, a sheriff who spent the previous 110 minutes failing to catch the most diabolical villain since Henry Fonda in Once Upon a Time in the West. To play Ellis, Corbin drew on memories of seeing old men in wheelchairs during his youth in La Mesa and Lubbock. Back then, he told me, we thought they were used up. When I did the scene, I was thinking about what they felt like inside, which is what they were when they were 30. But nobody sees that. The scene is only 5 minutes long, yet it somehow encapsulates the relentless evil in the movie and the world. Corbin, then 66, did what he's done since he was young. He spun a story. Bearded and confined to a wheelchair in a squalid desert shack, Ellis tells his nephew how one of their kin was killed 70 years before by Indians. It's a remarkable monologue of violence, death, and finally burial, in that old hard caliche told in Corbin South, slow Texas plains drawl. When he's done, Ellis tries to comfort his nephew, who is quitting the sheriff's department, feeling overmatched. What you got ain't nothing new, Corbin says, staring at Jones under heavy brow, his face lined with shadows and age. His country's hard on people. You can't stop what's coming. Ain't all waiting on you. That's vanity. The message that there's only so much a good person can do about evil runs contrary to the themes of almost every traditional Western ever made, where heroes triumph and justice is done. The look on Corbin's face, as well as his delivery, makes it seem as if King Lear himself has been dressed in grubby overalls and dropped into the West Texas desert. The look on Jones's face says he believes every word. 1991, after filming the first season of Northern Exposure, Corbin got a phone call from his agent that would change his life. A young woman named Shannon Ross was claiming to be his daughter. Corbin called Ross and within minutes realized she was indeed his child. Her mother and Corbin had had a fling in 1964, but the mother had never told him about their daughter. Ross, who lived in Arlington, Texas, had sought him out because one of her two kids had cerebral palsy, and she wanted to know if her birth father had similar issues. Soon, Corbin and Ross were talking every day, and he would often fly her and her family out to Seattle, where he was living at the time. Corbin kept a couple of horses and was delighted to find that Ross also rode. He would break out his trip rope and perform for the kids. Corbin had recently taken to riding cutting horses and entering competitions in celebrity rodeos. It's like riding a bucking horse, except he goes backwards and sideways, he said. Best all-around equine athletes that there are. All a racehorse knows how to do is turn left. A cutting horse has to mirror the moves of a cow, and the closer you can get to mirroring those moves, the higher your score is going to be, and the only cues you have are leg pressure and a spur. When Corbin's work in Northern Exposure earned him an Emmy nomination in 1993, he and Ross rode horses to the ceremony. That year, Corbin's second marriage ended. 2 years later, Northern Exposure shot its final episode, and Corbin found himself drifting. Visiting his sons in California, sleeping on Ross's couch, he was ready to move back to Texas, and Ross, also recently divorced, was ready to move in with him. Corbin bought a 15-acre ranch in East Fort Worth that had once belonged to former Texas Rangers manager Bobby Valentine. He brought his horses from Seattle and bought 6 head of cattle and a bull. Now that the series was over, he returned to Westerns, doing The Journeyman with Willie Nelson and Crossfire Trail, a film that for a few years was the most popular made-for-TV movie ever. By then, Corbin was in his 6th age, with spectacles on his nose, and began looking for projects that could connect him with his roots. He'd grown up hearing stories about Charles Goodnight, the legendary cowboy and cattle baron who had established the J.A. Ranch, Caladura Canyon, south of Amarillo. Corbin latched onto the idea of doing a one-act play. I thought, we need to pay our respects to this guy. He's the reason, in large part, that Texas is what it is today, Corbin. Goodnight was a Renaissance man with no real education who learned from observing. He was a businessman, but he was a dreamer more than anything else. Corbin knew Goodnight's world, the way people talked and acted, and wanted to set the play on the last night of his life, looking back over the previous 93 years. In 1996, Corbin sought out poet Andy Wilkinson, who had composed an album of songs and verse about Goodnight, to collaborate. When Charles Goodnight's Last Night opened, Corbin did his own makeup for the show, and his white hair and goatee so resembled the titular characters that Wilkinson's grandmother, who had known the cowman in her childhood, saw Corbin on stage and said, "My goodness, that's Uncle Charlie." "Corbin completely inhabited Goodnight," Wilkinson said. "Barry, you recognize that there's a human being giving you the role." A convenient stop to break here, natural stop in the story, reminds you that you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Sight and Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. Listen to Sight and Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight and Sound Broadcasting since 1967. Now back to our text. This is a great article. It's about Barry Corbin, the actor. It's entitled The Seven Ages of Barry Corbin. Now back to the story. A skull hangs over the door to Corbin's back office, the one that belonged to a bull named Will. The bull had been a gift from the Will Rogers Memorial Museum in Claremore, Oklahoma, which gave it to Corbin in 1995. Corbin kept Will with his cattle and two horses on the ranch when he first moved back to Texas, but after the drought of 2003, he gave away the cows and passed Will along to a rancher friend who had a large herd and room for Will to roam. One day in 2010, Will wandered off. When he saw him again, a year or later, some cowboys found his skeleton. "He was sort of a good friend of mine," Corbin told me, nodding at the skull. Corbin has no livestock anymore. One of his horses died 10 years ago, and he gave the other to a children's riding program. In 2012, Corbin and Ross moved from the ranch to a compound of several homes in Handley, not far from the grave of Lee Harvey Oswald. It's more urban there, no place for animals. Corbin married Jo, his third wife, in 2015, and since then they've lived across the street from Ross and her second husband. One wall of the office is a bow to Corbin's past, adorned with awards, plaques, and honors from various Texas Halls of Fame and the Screen Actors Guild. There are a dozen bronze statues, cowboys on horseback, cowboys roping calves, cowboys standing alone. The sculptures commemorate a bygone way of life, one Corbin saw vestiges of as a child and then wound up playing on screen. He told me his favorite award came from the Hall of Great Western Performers at the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum in Oklahoma City, basically the Smithsonian for cowboys. Tom Mix was the first one inducted, Corbin said, looking at a statue of a cowboy turned to the side on horseback with one hand holding the reins and the other dangling beside him. And then Gary Cooper, John Wayne was in there somewhere. Corbin was inducted in 2018, a year after Alan Ladd, and a year before Kevin Costner. I told him I thought the cowboy was gazing reflectively into the distance. Corbin reckoned that, more likely, he was counting cattle. Hollywood doesn't make many westerns these days. That bothers Corbin, who's spent much of the past decade shooting TV shows like Anger Management, The Ranch, and Modern Family. "There are no movie horses," he told me. "No wagons left, no stagecoaches. The stuntmen think a horse is like a motorcycle. I'm looking for a reason to get on horseback while I can still do it. It's not going to be long before I can't get up there." He said he'd like to do one more western. He smiled when I reminded him of a line from Buffalo Alter. Sitting on his horse, that old man looked about 20 years younger. I asked him about the last time he rode competitively, and he leaned back and showed me a bright gold belt buckle. 2000 Celebrity Champion, it read. The buckle came from the National Cutting Horse Association's annual Cancer Care Services event in Fort Worth. "That's the last buckle I won," Corbin said. "Last time I got on a cutting horse was before we shut down for this virus." "How did it feel?" "Good. As soon as I got on the horse and started loping around a little bit, I was right back where I used to be. I'm not going to win anything right now, but, you know, I'm not as much of a daredevil as I used to be either." Corbin wants the pandemic to end as soon as possible. He dreams of going back to work and keeps a bag packed in his closet, as he has for most of his professional life. "Usually my jobs come up at the last minute. They'll call on Tuesday and say I have to be in New Zealand on Thursday. Until the calls start coming again, he bides his time watching old movies, taking walks through his neighborhood, and keeping up with the world. Spend a lot of time out here," he said, "reading the paper, looking at TV, cutting up some of these articles, trying to educate somebody," which nobody would ever be. Perhaps Corbin became a great American character actor because he's a natural who spent a lifetime honing his talent, but to hear him tell it, he's learned the most from keeping his eyes open. "It informs me who I am," he told me. A lot of people work too hard at acting. It's all about human behavior. I never tire of people watching. You learn things every day from living. He maintains a sanguine view of the world and his place in it, posting photos on Facebook of him and Joe and his kids, as well as videos of himself reading children's books and talking to fans in the spring after one of them informed him that 99.5 The Wolf had, for some reason, decided to end its association with him. The fan had called the station, which never actually contacted Corbin. The actor posted a video message to The Wolf. Instead of hiring a grievance, Corbin smiled into the camera. "Good luck," he said in his familiar lilt. "I want to thank you sincerely for a great 20 years, and I've enjoyed every minute of it." As with anything, Barry Corbin says, it sounded like he meant every word. Next up, we turn back to our state section and an article that comes with some pretty relevant, recent relevance here. This is in The Culture. It's books by Casey Mitchell, Breaking Badly. During the 19th century, the Republic of Texas inspired secessionist movements across North America, but in the end, it couldn't even save itself. December 29th, 2020 marks the 175th anniversary of the United States annexation of the Republic of Texas, an occasion that Texans seem to have mixed feelings about. On the one hand, Texans love their country as much as any other American. On the other hand, nostalgia for the Republic's decade of independence is ingrained in the Texas character. After talk of secession seems to be on the rise during this politically fraught time, after the presidential election was called for Joe Biden, Texas Congressman Randy Weber posted a pro-secession meme on his Facebook page. A pair of recently published books offer sharp insights into what we should make of this contradiction. Journalist Richard Kreitner's Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union by Little Brown and Company, and historian Thomas Richard Jr.'s Breakaway America's, The Unmanifest Future of the Jacksonian United States, Johns Hopkins University Press, demonstrate that the Republic of Texas played an outsized role in our nation's development by inspiring other groups to strike out on their own. And they prompt us to ask some hard questions. What would have happened if Washington had rejected Texas entreaties to be annexed? Would Texas have managed to carve out an independent path and spurred others to do the same, upending the map of North America as we know it? Or would a Republic of Texas that never joined the Union have eventually wrecked on the shore of its own ambitions? Reitner and Richards don't explicitly address such counterfactuals, but they both point to some pretty clear answers. Neither book focuses exclusively on Texas. Break It Up ranges more widely from New England's and California's separatist flirtations during the antebellum period to the anarchist and feminist secessionisms that proliferated after the Civil War and continue to this day. Kreitner, a contributor to the liberal magazine The Nation, particularly shines when he focuses on the pre-Civil War era of disunionism, the age of breakaway republics, he calls it, making clear that Texas served as the model for other regions in the United States that were looking, in Sam Houston's words, to lift their heads and stand among the nations. Others, though, including many Texans involved in wresting the territory from Mexico, saw Texas not as a model of independence, but as the very opposite, yet another building block in the creation of the U.S. empire. Generations of American expansionists and adventurers had schemed to pry Texas from Spain by means fair or foul, Kreitner writes. Aaron Burr, a man who plotted to create his own North American polity west of the Mississippi, viewed Texas as the shimmering western gem in his new imperial crown. In many ways, the American obsession with that jewel and the fact that Texas could provide yet another outpost for slavery inspired many of the rebels of the Texas Revolution who had every intention of joining the United States once they extricated themselves from Mexico. Without American support, the Texas Revolution would have failed, as the American would have without French assistance, Kreitner writes of the enthusiastic provision of arms, munitions, and bodies to the rebels. After 1821, when Mexico won independence from Spain, hardliners in the United States, i.e., those dedicated to Texas annexation, vowed to take the region one way or another. Eventually, those hardliners won out. In 1845, after a decade of propping up the nascent Texas Republic, the United States plucked that jewel, pocketing it in its parade to the Pacific. But during that interim, Texas independence inspired dreams of different, distant futures, futures that didn't necessarily require being part of the United States. In Break It Up, Kreitner details stories overlooked in most histories of the country's 19th century. For instance, Thanks to Texas's success in cracking off of Mexico, the leading American separatist group at the time, thousands of Mormons, restless in Illinois, looking to find a home beyond the reach of Washington, nearly chose South Texas over Salt Lake City. The Mormons had closely followed Texan developments, sympathizing with another experiment in independence rights. Perhaps the Republic of Texas could host the wayward Latter-day Saints. Perhaps Texas could be their new Zion, Kreitner continues. Sam Houston was all ears. Warring with Comanches, wary of Mexico's attempt to reclaim its lost province, worried that annexation to the United States would never happen, Houston believed that allowing the Mormons to settle in southern Texas offered advantages for both sides. Texas would have a buffer, defended by the Mormons' impressive militia, between itself and Mexico, while the Saints could finally have a land all their own, far from their American tormentors. Those dreams of a Texan-Mormon alliance never came to fruition, largely because raging Americans murdered Mormon founder Joseph Smith soon thereafter. The new leader, Brigham Young, Kreitner says, broke off talks with Texas because he believed, rightly, that the Lone Star State was gravitating toward eventual American annexation. And so Texas's underbelly remained soft, ripe for revanchist Mexico to come storming northward once more. Rather than the Mormons and the Texans allying and mutually reinforcing independence, both went their separate ways and perhaps as a result ended up in America's embrace. A little sidebar here from Russia with memes. Many Texans' longtime interest in reestablishing an independent republic prompted Russian trolls to create a secessionist Facebook page during the 2016 election that gained hundreds of thousands of Texas followers who thrilled to such near-English slogans as "In love with Texas shape." Back to our text. Richards, a history teacher at a private school in Philadelphia who researched much of breakaway Americas while doing postdoctoral work at Southern Methodist University, writes in a more academic style than Kreitner, but his book is never boring. Much of its interest stems from the subject material itself, which examines the ripples of Texas independence in places like Oregon, Canada, and the Indian Territory, consisting largely of what is now eastern Oklahoma, all of which looked to the Texas Republic for inspiration. In many ways, the mid-19th century was a long Texas moment, Richard argues. Thus, when other Americans throughout the continent thought of establishing their own independent polities, they thought of Texas, spoke of Texas, wrote of Texas, and in some cases, imagined themselves as would-be Texans. Texas became a language through which to understand the future geopolitics of the continent. As an example, Richard recounts a long-forgotten historical episode, the so-called Patriot War of 1837 and 1838, in which a group of self-proclaimed patriots on both sides of the United States' northern border sought to seize a piece of British Canada for themselves. Inspired by the success of Texans just a year prior, the patriots envisioned a new independent chunk of present-day Ontario acting as a buffer between the U.S. and British forces. Of course, Great Britain was a far more daunting foe than Mexico, and the U.S. government hardly warmed to the prospect of funneling arms and munitions to groups looking to assault what was then the world's leading military power. This would-be Texas on the tundra was stillborn, but the effort nonetheless proves that the Texas moment was truly a continent-wide phenomenon, as Richards writes. And it was hardly the only area looking at its future through a Texas lens. Once again, Mormons sought to escape the grasp of the states, leaving Illinois in early 1846 for an empty expanse of northern Mexico, looking to carve out their own polity with little more than God and gunpowder on their side. Around the same time, early settlers on the Oregon Territory, a far-flung part of the United States proper, openly suggested that they would seek independence if the country refused to protect them from British predation. In mid-1840s, California, then an undergoverned swath of northern Mexico, Spanish-speaking Californios looked to Texas as a model of independence for their own province. Unfortunately for their dream of a California republic, a flood of American settlers racing into the region drew a more cynical inspiration from Texas's example. They were eager to play what American newspapers called the Texas game, which Richards defines as declaring an independent California republic and then seeking admission to the United States. Even relocated Native Americans peopling the Indian Territory looked with envy and enthusiasm at the success of the Texas movement. Of course, an independent California, an Oregon Republic, and a Federation of United Indians never materialized. Though Texas may have inspired many imitators, its time as a republic, however brief, remained sui generis. But break it up and breakaway Americas also undercut the mythology that, to this day, colors our view of Texas independence. As Kreitner and Richards make clear, the Republic of Texas was in many ways an unimpressive republic. Held together by spit and tar and pleas for bodies and bullets from America, the Republic resembled the straw house and the three little pigs. One push from an organized Mexican military or an end to the aid and arms provided by the Americans, and the entire facade of independence could have come tumbling down. Anglo-Texans realized all too well that if Mexico could get its act together politically, it could then launch another devastating invasion of Texas that the Texans would be unlikely to defeat on their own, Richards writes. As Andrew Jackson's emissary to Texas observed, the Republic's security depended more upon the weakness and imbecility of her enemy than upon her own strength. Nor was this simply a matter of Mexican military primacy or the fact that Mexico's population was magnitudes larger than Texas's. Post-1836, according to one historian cited in Breakaway America, Texas remained a barnyard republic, a rural, rudimentary affair, barely scraping by without the basic instruments of statehood. Its economy was, for the most part, in shambles. Its military was ineffectual, Richards adds. Both were kept afloat only by a steady migration of Americans pouring in. The new Texas government, hemmed in by Comanches, Kiowa, and Revanchist Mexicans, controlled at most 20% of the territory it claimed, and legislators in Washington appeared lukewarm about annexation, despite the territory's value as a new slave state, and despite the fact that Texas had sought support from Britain, the bete noire of antebellum America. Nor did its leadership do much to help matters. President Mirabeau B. Lamar's policies, including his genocidal thrust against Native American populations and his failed efforts to occupy Santa Fe, bankrupted the revenue-strapped Texas government, Richards writes. All of which point to an unequivocal answer to one of the questions posed at the beginning of this piece. If Washington hadn't finally agreed to annex Texas, there would have been little hope for the fledgling republic. Whether its collapse would have been brought about by a resurgent Mexico, an imperial United States, which Kreitner says would have viewed Texas as a rival and a menace, or the kind of infighting that doomed other secessionist pushes, Texas independence was fated to failure. Not that most Texans thought otherwise. After Houston's victory at San Jacinto in 1836, Texans held a vote on what they should do next. As Richards recounts, a 97% majority voted to pursue annexation to the United States. To put it another way, the seeds of the Republic of Texas' demise were sown at the moment of its birth, while the bodies in the battlefield of San Jacinto were still warm. As the political scientist Richard Maas recently wrote in The Picky Eagle, How Democracy and Xenophobia Limited U.S. Territorial Expansion, far from fueling resistance to American annexation, Texas nationalism was U.S. nationalism. Yet the romance of Texan nationalism has never died. While Richards' book sticks with the 19th century, Kreitner's engages with current political moment, assessing our recent strains of fracture and fratricide. Today, a startling plurality of Americans foresee a Civil War redux in our future, and according to a September poll from Hofstra University, nearly 40% of us are comfortable with the notion of states seceding from the country. And where there's the smoke of separatism, there's usually the fire of Texas independence. As Kreitner reminds us, Texas secessionism has in recent years seen new life, thanks to agitation by both homegrown malcontents and foreign entities seeking to create discord here. From Rick Perry lobbying suggestions about Texas secession a decade ago to leaders of the Texas nationalist movement traveling to Moscow as part of Rush's 2016 interference efforts, the notion of Texas as making an outright push for renewed independence isn't nearly as fantastical as we once thought. Given how unlikely our current political situation would have seemed even 10 years ago, Kreitner's willingness to take such seemingly far-fetched movements seriously seems prudent. The sudden surge of interest in Texas independence, though, relies heavily on the myths still swamping the realities of the ramshackle Republic of Texas. Rather than the gloried society of legend, the Republic portrayed by Richards and Kreitner had only two plausible destinies, annexation or disaster, which almost certainly led to annexation anyway. The original Texans knew which one they preferred. As the final Texas president, Anson Jones, said when lowering the Republic of Texas flag for the last time, "The final act in this great drama is now performed. The Republic of Texas is no more. Long may it rest." The author of this piece, Casey Michelle, a graduate of Rice University and a former staff writer for the Houston Press, has written for numerous publications, including Foreign Policy and The Atlantic. Next up, another little short item from Steak. This is food and drink. It's a recipe from Paula Mejia. It's entitled this month, is Spread the Love. Homemade hot pepper jelly is a vibrant, versatile condiment and a righteous kick to the system. The first time I made hot pepper jelly, a sumptuous and piquant blend of spicy pepper, sugar, lemon, and apple cider vinegar, I expected to feel the burn on my tongue, not on my fingers. Alas, I contracted a brutal case of hot pepper hands caused when capsaicin, a chemical compound found in chilies, comes in contact with skin. But once the pain evaporated, it was all pleasure. I slathered the relish on bread, crackers with cream cheese, of course, even ice cream. Hot pepper jelly is said to have originated in Lake Jackson in the 70s with recipe variations. Green pepper ketchup, anyone? Go back much further. Regardless, its popularity in Texas is indisputable. Adapted from a recipe by Emily Lozon, an Austin home cook who shares her culinary adventures on Instagram, this rendition includes strawberries. Their natural pectins give the jelly its thickness. A paste of cornstarch and water can achieve the same effect, but I like the sweetness of the berries. As for hot pepper hands, I reached out to Diana Barrios Trevino, co-owner of San Antonio's Los Barrios restaurants. Her advice, wear plastic or rubber gloves while chopping those chilies. Here's a recipe for hot pepper jelly. It makes 1 8-ounce jar. Half a shallot diced, 1 habanero pepper seeded and diced, 1 bell pepper seeded and diced, 1 jalapeno pepper seeded and diced, 1 serrano pepper seeded and diced, 1 tablespoon of butter, 1/2 teaspoon red pepper flakes or more to taste, 1/2 cup of brown sugar, 1/4 cup apple cider vinegar, 1/2 lemon juiced, and 1/4 cup of strawberries chopped, or substitute a mixture of 1 tablespoon cornstarch and 2 tablespoons of water. In a small saucepan, stir the shallot, peppers, butter, red pepper flakes, sugar, and vinegar over medium heat until the sugar is dissolved and the butter is melted. Bring to a boil and reduce heat to low. Simmer for about 30 minutes, stirring occasionally until the jelly is reduced and somewhat thickened. Add the lemon juice and chopped strawberries or cornstarch mixture and cook over low heat until the strawberries are broken down and the jelly is thickened, about 25 to 30 more minutes. Remove from heat and let it cool. Jelly will continue to thicken as it cools, but if it's still a little watery, you can return to the heat for a few more minutes or add more cornstarch. Store it in a lidded glass jar in a refrigerator for as long as 3 months. Next up, we're going to flip to the dining guide. This is the takeout edition. It's edited by Patricia Sharp and Courtney Bond. Still, these pages offer a changing selection of restaurant reviews each month. Prior to May of last year, Texas Monthly reviewed in-restaurant dining. From May through October, reviews were not published because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Starting November 2020 and until further notice, Texas Monthly restaurant critics will cover to-go meals only. You see past reviews at www.texasmonthly.com/dining-guide. Turn down to Houston. First up, Bistro 55 is a new French place. Former Bistro Provence has been refashioned and refreshed with a country chic look, a new seasonal menu featuring 5 appetizers, 5 entrees, and 5 desserts. That's the new name. Order this to go. Gone are some of our favorites, like the salad Nicoise, coq au vin, but in our stead is a salad lyonnaise, frilly frisée, bacon bites, a lovely vinaigrette, a perfectly poached egg, and braised rabbit leg with fork tender meat and a creamy mustard sauce with toothsome greens. Another stellar option is a canal de salmon, wild salmon with a snapper mousse, toasty on top, nestled in a bowl of earthy mushroom sauce. Desserts are star-studded too, like decadent chocolate hazelnut mousse, classic apple crisp with cinnamon ice cream. Pro tip, check out the restaurant's Zoom dinners. You order a 3-course meal with wine pairings, then join your hosts and fellow diners online at a designated time. 13616 Memorial Drive, bistro555.com. And then Crawfish Cafe is a new seafood place. Crawfish fans are flocking to this new Viet Cajun outpost in the Heights to gobble up family-sized portions of mudbugs bathed in spicy butter plus boudin balls, saucy wings, crawfish egg rolls, fried and boiled seafood plates galore. Order this to go. Crawfish are the thing here, of course, plump and tender with custom sauces, kicking Cajun, lemon pepper, Thai basil, and so on. The salt and pepper blue crabs are rich and tasty, but heavy on salt for your information. Cajun fried rice, spicy sausage, shrimp, and crawfish is popular, as are sides of Cajun spice, boiled potatoes, and corn on a cob. Skip the too bready fried okra. Pro tip, it's easy to miss a small sign for the curbside pickup area. It's on the opposite side of the building from the parking lot. It's at 1026 North Shepherd Drive. Crawfishcafe.com on the net. Eunice, updating the Creole place. Refined Creole might best describe its dependable spot. Expect fresh, well-prepared seafood, equally appealing meaty choices, including a mega burger. order this to go, hand pull burrata to pile on biscuits with sweet pepper jelly and a grilled ribeye, more than enough for two, with a pile of wild mushrooms, dollops of fresh salsa verde, and whole baby potatoes resting in béarnaise. Peanut butter pie and bread pudding vie for top desserts. And a pro tip, although tempting, items from the Raw Seafood Bar are not available for takeout. Great patio if you simply must have the Royal Red Shrimp with remoulade, which we highly recommend. 3737 Buffalo Speedway, unisrestaurant.com. MDK Noodles is a new Korean place. It's a Korean noodle house on LA, an LA import. An exciting addition to Asia Town with an accessible menu of noodles, soups, dumplings, and bibimbap, a rice bowl loaded with meat and vegetables. Order this to go. We orchestrated our meal mindfully. For instance, we quickly tucked in the hot steamed dumplings, thoughtfully packaged delicate dough stuffed with well-seasoned pork and shrimp. Likewise, we chose to cook at home kalguksu, super long knife-cut noodles, chicken broth to cook them in, and a tidy container of chicken, slivered vegetables, and cute little pork dumplings. Bulgogi bibimbap, loaded with smoky sweet beef, piled atop fresh cucumbers, carrots, sprouts, and radish, proved a worthy rendition and made for fabulous leftovers. Pro tip, peruse the website, get the full menu with descriptions and pictures. Once you click order now, the photos vanish. It's at 9798 Bel Air Boulevard. Ostia is a new Italian place. It's Houston native Travis McShane returns home in triumph from New York and opens a spot worthy of his star chef status. Order this to go. Simple and simply superb is a huge half chicken au jus spiked with lime juice. Three tender harissa bathed whole shrimp travel well in their shells and tasty great. Also good were al dente fusilli with pistachio pesto and burrata, sections of corn on a cob, charred and oh-so-sweet, touched with aioli and pecorino. Pro tip, pull up near the valet who will direct you to a parking spot. Then either go in or ask for the food to be brought to your car at 2032 Dunleavy, ostiahu.com. Saigon Hustle's a new Vietnamese place. Hustle over to the Blodge at Food Hall for traditional Vietnamese dishes updated brilliantly by Chef Cassie Gahar. Order this to go. The hefty, satisfying portions travel well. Our favorites were a banh mi with honey soy barbecue chicken, a salad with sweet lemongrass-scented crispy tofu, a vermicelli bowl with char-grilled ribeye and vegetables, and a rice bowl with salmon. Pro tip, there's no phone, so order for pickup online. Our food was ready when we arrived and handed off by a properly masked employee at 2616 Blodgett, thesaigonhustle.com on the net. Squabble is an updated new American place, home to the signature towering French cheeseburger. This place never stops coming up with modern European surprises. Order this to go. A side of macerated beets with blood orange, dill, and pine nuts livened up a tender leg of lamb. We added cracked black pepper for oomph, and its accompanying chickpea frites with salty, spicy harissa. Lasagne a la norma with eggplant, green tomato sauce, and a blizzard of ricotta salata will appease vegetarians. Don't pass up the house-made bread or eye-popping desserts like a caramelized persimmon tart. Pro tip, alas, no one answered the phone when we arrived to fetch our order, so you may want to pick up your food inside unless you like waiting in your car indefinitely. 632 West 19th, squabbletime.com on the net. And lastly, Woodshed Smokehouse. It's a new barbecue place. Chef Tim loves Woodshed Smokehouse, a favorite in Fort Worth. Smoking hot here, too. Four of us fork fought over a shared meal of eight dishes, with none of them disappointing. Prices are reasonable, too. Order this to go. Kudos to the Bock Beer Cheese Fondue. Exclamation point. Elevated queso, served with vegetables and camp bread for dipping. Bulgogi beef tacos, sweet and savory and popped up by house-made kimchi, and the crispy potatoes with hickory-smoked garlic aioli. All the usual queue is available, too, as well as some that's not so traditional, like rabbit rattlesnake sausage. Pro tip, Woodshed sits beside beautiful little Levy Park, so consider a 3728 Wake Forest Avenue on the internet at woodshedhouston.com. And that very conveniently brings us to the end of our reading for today. You've been listening to Texas Monthly Magazine, Saturdays at 5 and Mondays at 2 p.m. on site and at Sound Broadcasting.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 68 and clear. Tonight, a few showers with a low in the upper 40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 50s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the mid-40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McGlamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight and Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the Texas Highways website, and our first one is titled, Six Texas Day Trips to Drive Away the Winter Blues. Hop in your car and social distance your way through these less traveled parts of Texas. Written by Joe Nick Potoski. Since the outbreak of COVID-19, my wife and I have been laying low. Our ages and autoimmune issues put us squarely in the highest at-risk category. We wear masks and maintain social distancing whenever we go out in public, mostly to the HEB, the gas pump, and the closest P. Terry's Burger Stand drive-thru. At the same time, we both have been itching to get out and get away. We're travelers at heart. But it seems like almost every time we've contemplated going somewhere during the past year, we get tripped up by pondering a stay at a hotel or Airbnb. Strange bed, strange room, thoroughness of disinfection unknown. Our solution? Taking a day drive. Just get in a vehicle, drive an hour or more to a cool spot, get some fresh air, take a walk or hike, eat a prepackaged meal or score some takeout at a safe distance, then drive home. The idea came from a friend who took quick no-contact trips to several state parks over the summer. She would buy day passes or reserve an overnight campsite online in advance. Other acquaintances have been doing something similar, hitting small towns just beyond their urban city limits. Here are a few day trips that make getting away a safe and easy adventure. Keep in mind, mileage and time varies depending on traffic, speed, and irresistible diversions. The Upper Coastal Loop of Galveston Bay. Directions, starting from Houston, start by taking exit 810 on Interstate 10, about 40 miles east of downtown Houston. Head south on Farm to Market Road, 563 to Anahuac, and pick up Farm to Market Road for 10 miles to Double Bayou. Drive south on Farm to Market Road 562 for 17 miles to Smith Point, or from Double Bayou, take FM 563 and Farm to Market Road 1985 to the Anahuac Wildlife Refuge, Smith Oaks and High Island, 25 miles away. Time, 5 hours. It may be the second largest bay complex in the United States, but too often Galveston Bay is taken for granted, or worse, ignored. Rectify that with a driving tour of the east side of Texas's Big Bay, the beginning of a coastal circumnavigation of Houston. This journey goes through Anahuac, the self-proclaimed alligator capital of Texas, on the banks of the Trinity River, and Double Bayou, site of an historic juke joint in a rural African-American community. Venture to Smith Point to overlook the least peopled part of Galveston Bay, or visit Anahuac Wildlife Refuge, Smith Oaks, and High Island, three sites that offer some of the finest birding and wildlife viewing on the continent, rife with nature trails. Running 25 miles from High Island down the Bolivar Peninsula to the Galveston Ferry Landing, where you can stay in your car and take a free ride across the mouth of Galveston Bay. Once across, detour through the Strand Historic District and Broadway Street to admire the elaborate architecture of two centuries ago. Then head for Seawall Boulevard to start following the Gulf again on the left. Getting through Galveston can be a slow crawl, especially on weekends. But once you've reached Galveston Island State Park, a fine stopping point if you've reserved a timed day pass online in advance, the road opens up as Termini San Luis Pass Road. San Luis Pass marks the end of Galveston Island and the beginning of Follett's Island and Surfside. A county park across the bridge is a good spot to pause before continuing down the beach on the road that is now the Blue Water Highway, ending 14 miles later at Surfside Beach, arguably the most unassuming coastal village in Texas, near the mouth of the Brazos River. Surfside offers walking along the Blue Water Highway Nature Trail, or the Bird and Butterfly Trail, a playground at Jetty Park, and takeout options at places such as the Red Snapper Inn, La Taquerita de Surfside, Jerry Shack, or the Beachfront Deck Bar and Grill. From Surfside, it's just 8 miles on State Highway 332 to Nolan Ryan Expressway and the road back to Houston. The Painted Churches of Fayette County. Directions, starting from Houston, San Antonio, or Austin. To get to Schulenburg, drive 90 minutes from Houston or San Antonio via Interstate 10, or 90 minutes from Austin via State Highway 71 and U.S. 77. Sites are within a few miles of U.S. 77 and stretch for 15 miles between Schulenburg and LaGrange. Day trip, 3 to 4 hours. For this trip, we set out for Schulenburg, a town of 2,800 founded by Germans with a significant Czech population. After picking up a painted church's map at the Chamber of Commerce and Tourism Center for $5, we looked around downtown Schulenburg, where we found takeout food at Tilly's across the street from the chamber, the historic Singelmann Hall a block away, and the Stanzel Model Airplane Museum a few blocks over. We poked our heads in at the Texas Polka Music Museum to check out artifacts from the area's most popular indigenous music. Next time, we'll buy a CD at the museum so we can have an appropriate soundtrack for touring the churches. Off we went to Dabena, about a 10-minute drive away. Crossing the funky one-lane suspension piano bridge, built in 1885, we found the oldest Czech Moravian community in Texas. Established in 1857, Dabena is a classic presentation of cemetery, church, and adjacent dance hall, the essentials of Czech and German immigrant farming communities in the area. The church of St. Cyril and Methodius Catholic Church was built here in 1911 following the storm of 1909 that pretty much destroyed the settlement of Dabena. From Dabena, we drove north through Ammonsville to Swiss Alp, where we passed by the close to derelict remnants of the dance hall that gave B.J. Thomas his start on our way to the Philadelphia's Evangelical Lutheran Church. Founded by German-Swiss immigrants, this church was built in 1890 and is pretty enough, but nowhere near as elaborately painted as the other Catholic churches on this trail, such as St. Mary's at High Hill. A Gothic Revival sanctuary, St. Mary's was erected by the Austrian immigrant community with the arches and columns of a European cathedral. Further west in Freiburg is the remnant of a German settlement and site of the sole Methodist church on the tour. Built in 1878, the church has its original wooden benches and altar and a minimalist interior, minus embellishments beyond the exterior steeple. Our tour wrapped up at St. Mary's Church of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary, 10 miles west in Praha, near Flatonia, just off U.S. 90. This was the most impressive sanctuary. The celestial robin's egg blue vaulted ceiling with trompe-l'oeil ribs made to look like stone were painted by Godfrey Fleury, a Swiss immigrant from nearby Multan, in 1895, and never touched up. If we had started earlier, we would have budgeted time for a hike around Monument Hill overlooking LaGrange, site of the historic Crèche Brewery. But 3 hours in Fayette County was enough of a purposeful meander along country roads with sights that take you back in time and remind you that these churches, ranging from starkly simple to Sistine Chapel magnificent, meant to the area's immigration population. The real Old El Paso Drive. Directions, starting from downtown El Paso. From downtown, take Loop 375, Expressway 11 miles to Exit 48, Socorro Road, then 8 miles to San Elizario and San Elizario Presidio Chapel. Day trip time, about 4 hours. Take a step even further back in history, exploring the missions and chapels near El Paso. They'll put you in another time frame of mind, no matter where you're coming from. But before setting out, I advise mapping out an itinerary with the El Paso Mission.